Hello, everyone, and welcome to a new episode of Required Reading. I apologize for the complexity of our schedule, but unfortunately, it's just been busy for all of us, and therefore these episodes are not coming out as consistently as I would like. However, we promise that the content will come out and it will maintain our high expectations. With this in mind, keep doing what you do to keep us on the charts. Keep sharing us, keep listening, and giving us our feedback. We appreciate hearing from each and every one of you, and we hope that you can read along with us and encourage us, because that's what I need right now as our school year is beginning. Thanks, everyone. Welcome to Required Reading. This week we get a little spooky and we talk Max Brooks's World War Z from 2006, an epistolary?
Yeah,
an epistolary novel? Yeah. Mystery novel about surviving the zombie apocalypse by the prodigy, or by the offspring, I guess, of Mel Brooks.
Mm-hmm.
I'm your host, Nick Hoffman, and on panel we have
Mike Carroll
and Mike Burns.
We have been in Mike and I's American Experiment class pushing a lot of postmodern novels, including previous episode Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close. And so we were thinking, let's do something a little bit ooky spooky, but also something in a modern novel style. And we stumbled across this at our very intense planning session at an Irish pub. And I read this when it came out in 2006. I was by the pool. It was nice, and it was ooky spooky. Like, it was exactly what I wanted for, I think it came out in the winter of 2006. So I was reading it summer 2007. It was fantastic. It became a movie starring Brad Pitt, which is completely different. They bought the title and then wrote a script later on. But I'm interested to see how the rest of you liked it. So what's your history with this book?
Yeah, so for me, I had first encountered A Zombie Survival Guide, and which is also a book written by Max Brooks. And I really liked that.
And that came out first, right?
Yeah, it did.
Which I didn't know either.
I really liked the Zombie Survival Guide, and kind of like, I can remember, I must have gotten it for Christmas or something like that. And I can remember paging through it. And then once I had finished making my way through it, you know, it's funny. I can remember being a lifeguard up on the North Shore of Boston, and on like rainy days, sitting on top of the guard shack, and when there wasn't anybody in the pool, I had a couple of other like-minded lifeguards who I would sit up there with and talk about, like, if the zombie apocalypse were to come, how we would best prepare for it. And it was at that time that I was paging my way through and making my way through the Zombie Survival Guide. And then once I finished with that, one of those lifeguards had turned me on to World War Z. And so I went to the library and actually took it out of the library and started to make my way through it, and then grew frustrated with the interview style, with the epistolary style that Nick, that you were talking about before. So I never ended up making my way through more than maybe a quarter of it. I think I was expecting a little bit more of a plot-driven, action-packed, thrillers type of a book, and that wasn't what World War Z was. I probably should have looked more closely at the cover, where it says that this is an oral history of the zombie war, which is absolutely what it is. But as a result, I ended up putting it down and never finishing it until reading it for the podcast. So I made my way through it. There were still aspects of the structure that I didn't like, but I think I appreciate them a little bit more now, and I can't wait to get into it with you guys. So
cool. I only knew it through the book or the movie first. I just knew the movie, saw Brad Pitt, thought it was like a summer blockbuster, kind of. It was better than I expected. But then when we came up with this title, and I started with the audiobook, actually, because just like driving around or listening on the bike at the Y or whatever. And it was really good because the cast, like, I didn't recognize that voice. And what I read apparently is like Max Brooks called in favors from his dad, or just growing up in Hollywood. So he's got like Alan Alda and Mark Hamill and all these sort of like iconic actors, Paul Sorvino. they were in the audiobook. So the audiobook was excellent. And then I went into the library, and the audiobook I had was only 6 hours. So it was a bridge version. But I really liked the different voices in that. And then I also read that he was inspired by Studs Terkel as far as oral history, like you just said, Mike, and working and so telling those different points of view. So I'm curious maybe why you didn't like that sort of fractured as a writer yourself, because I thought it was a great way to sort of pull in different voices or different perspectives. And yet it's missing that clear narrative arc, but
yeah,
you get a lot of different points of view. And then also then again, I was really curious about this in reading that I'd read a Max Brooks book like 2 summers ago. It was during the pandemic, actually. It's one called Devolution, which is about like this, there's a volcanic explosion in the Pacific Northwest and like, you know, civilization goes to hell. But like this family of Sasquatch sort of emerge in the woods of the Pacific Northwest. And then it becomes like this existential apocalyptic kind of survival, but these Sasquatch creatures are there. And so I was curious about like, who is Max Brooks? And then he's Mel Brooks' son, but he also is a teacher at the War College, U.S. War College. And so knowing that, and then looking at this book, it's essentially like a case study in war. And you can see how, and there's a lot of sort of war, I mean, it's a war book, but just sort of, you can play out scenarios of what if and try and train soldiers or get them to think that way. So that was an interesting background. And it sort of deepened the novel for me a little bit. I thought, oh, there's a lot more to it than just some dumb sort of my perception of a dumb zombie book, which it isn't. I think it's much more clever and thoughtful than that.
Yeah, and I will say that I hadn't ever seen the movie. I still haven't seen the movie.
Right.
And so I think that when I was first encountering World War Z, I was expecting a little bit more of kind of that stereotypical plot-driven story. And when it wasn't that, I think that that's originally what had turned me off to it. So that was kind of like a strike that, for better or for worse, I kind of had in the back of my mind against it. And then another strike that I had against it was when I realized that Max Brooks was indeed Mel Brooks' son. And I was like, oh man, there's no way that Mel Brooks' son can come out with like... I like to think that I've matured a little bit more than my 18, 19-year-old self, but I can think back to myself realizing that it was Mel Brooks' son that had written this story and thinking to myself, like, oh, he's no literary mind. Like, how could the son of Mel Brooks really come out with something that's all this great? Yada, yada, yada. But I think giving it a chance in retrospect and kind of now having taught Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close and being a little bit more familiar with some more postmodern literature and seeing the structure and treating this more as the cover dictates, an oral history rather than some sort of like blockbuster novel that's going to be a page turner for its plot, I think has given me a deeper appreciation of kind of like the story that's being told there. And it's very fragmented, as I'm sure that we'll get into. But it's kind of these various vignettes of this fictional war that has taken place in the universe that Max Brooks has created that I think really does give you a global sense of the story that he's creating. And then when I saw that Max Brooks also taught at the War College, it's like, okay, well, fine. I guess some of those passages where he's talking about some of the battle and some of the action-packed scenes that are chuck full in this story, okay, fine, I'll give him the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the expectation, certainly for me, I was expecting like a Jurassic Park kind of monster thriller, and it's not that, and it's different and excellent in its own way.
And just as far as the structure of this podcast will go, like Mike Burns was alluding to, it's a lot of very distinct voices. And the way this is set up, it's into 8 chapters.
Mm-hmm.
But the framework is kind of interesting because some of the stories are a little bit more funny. Some of them are true survival horror. Some of them are war stories. Some of them are like thriller. Like, and so he plays around with that genre.
Yeah.
Economics too. The whole Cuba thing is interesting.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
Yeah. And also like some of those entrepreneurs that are trying to make their buck off of like a terrible global situation.
Right.
Yeah, there's a lot of commentary going on.
Well, and it's just, we're probably not going to be able to touch on every story.
Right.
But he is our kind of omniscient narrator type guy, is going around the world trying to compile a story of the events of what becomes known as World War Z, for a vaguely UN-esque body to be the official record of what happened. And so the way he's assembled it is the first inkling something's wrong, the disease spreading, the war is imminent, the war itself, how we won the war, what's the aftermath, and like, and we'll get into it each way, but just know that there's a reason our discussion will be the way it is. It's just, it's not epistolary in the way that, say, Frankenstein is, where it's the same person talking the whole time. We get a whole bunch of different views, and to his credit, he gives them distinct voices and distinct feels to the way they tell their stories.
Yeah, and it's kind of for that exact reason, Nick, that you're bringing up, that the plot doesn't really drive it. It's all of these snippets and interviews, in fact, with a kind of like fictionalized version of Max Brooks himself, who in the world and universe of World War Z has written a civilian survival guide, which is right. Kind of like his homage, if you will, to his own zombie survival guide that he had written. So it's kind of blurring those lines between fiction and reality with an interviewer that is still shares, if nothing else, the same name as the author. And there's another book that he has written, just like the Zombie Survival Guide, that he has written as well. Even in the acknowledgments that come like right at the very end, not Max Brooks's acknowledgments, but Max Brooks's right. acknowledgments are still like very much kind of like interwoven into the end of the story. So it's really interesting the ways that he is kind of blurring those lines. And I think that it kind of creates this, I don't know, it's something unlike anything that I had read before. And while the structure of it does kind of resemble something like a, I don't know, almost like a collection of interviews or a collection of like nonfiction pieces. I'm thinking of some of the works of like Chuck Klosterman interviewing Bono, where you get kind of like that little snippet of a like some detailed descriptions at the very beginning, and then you get into the interview, and then you've got kind of like the final commentary on the interview that comes afterwards. It kind of follows that on repeat again and again and again and again as you gain a greater understanding of this world war that has transpired. So it's a really interesting structure. And the more that I'm talking about it with you guys, I think the more that I'm kind of buying into that kind of postmodern and unique structure. Though when I took this chair, I wasn't exactly sure, and I'm not entirely sure how it is that I ultimately feel about it.
When you're talking about like author or authorial identity, it makes me think of Tim O'Brien.
Oh, right?
Sort of slippery, and there's the real Tim O'Brien and there's the fictional one, but you can't quite tell how to tell a true war story. So mm-hmm. that's what I guess Brooks is doing here in his own way. Yeah.
So we kind of start at the start with the original outbreak, which is in China, right? Kind of related to...
Sound familiar, anybody?
Yeah, I know. I was reading this and I was like, oh, no.
Yeah, there's some parts that are so sort of relevant to COVID,
And we'll get to Israel as well, because they did try to lock down for COVID as well, which is just whatever. It's incredible. So we start with, I believe it's the building of the Three Gorges Dam, which is what they're trying to link it to. But we get this doctor's account. And he's, and if you've read Thousand Year Door, I'll look up the book I'm thinking of in a second, but it reads a lot like a lot of the accounts you get of the Black Death, the bubonic plague, mm-hmm. where there's like one monk who has survived and he's convinced that he might be the last man on earth. We have this doctor who visited the village where everyone seems to be having this weird rabies kind of thing. And he finds this person locked in a room, half dissolved, and before he knows, like, he's scooped up by the Chinese military, and we have this, you know, he just watches people start to die, mm-hmm. And then come back to life, which is remarkable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's kind of like patient zero, or the first patient of the Solanum virus, and the first attempts are kind of like, they attempt to kind of like sweep under the rug this zombie virus that is growing and spreading with a kind of like cover-up military crisis against Taiwan. And that is unsuccessful, the military crisis does end up transpiring, but the virus does not stop its spread due to migration, and there's a couple of snippets in there of like a doctor who's doing transplant surgery, and there's been some transplants of some of the organs that had made their way through like the black market into some surgery rooms that they should never have been in. So all of a sudden, this spread of this virus that was supposed to be swept under the rug and was supposed to be covered up, now all of a sudden is branching out everywhere. And that's when we get in South Africa, the spread there, and it's referred to for the first time as African rabies. And this is the kind of still all in the warnings section. It's like that first chapter called Warnings. And you're starting to see the rise of kind of like those first couple of blips that are showing up that are the warning signs that we've got something much, much, much bigger on our hands.
Well, and I assume to make a book like this, he's probably read 1,000 things and he's put it together. And like you said, he teaches military strategy. And I'm sure some of this is stuff he probably was told to not prepare for, but you know, like as a military guy, this is a war game. We're going to figure this out. But it does remind me of the book I was trying to think of, which is A Distant Mirror by Barbara Tuchman. And like the idea that these communities would lock down to try to prevent people from coming in. And like, they thought it was, oh, this is a poor person's disease. They talk about the favelas in Brazil. They talk about these, like, in South Africa, the poor communities. But then it ends up in the hospitals as well. And so the rich start to get infected. And then entire societal structures break down. Mm-hmm. And, like, you know, can you lock down an entire place? Well, the Israelis try to. And the big open plains of America become a problem because we can't track all that. Like, the way he thinks this through very early on, especially in this chapter, Warnings, having lived through COVID not long ago, it is amazing how much of a sieve all of our security is in this way and how quickly this kind of stuff can spread. And here, I mean, for those of you who are connoisseurs of zombies, we should just make it a little bit of the rules of these zombies because that actually matters here.
Yeah,
these are things that don't die until you destroy the head. Right. Mm-hmm. And it is spread through a bite, through like saliva contact with the healthy person. The person will die and then they will be resurrected and they will kind of drip and ooze and then they will act rabid. Mm-hmm. They will just try to attack whatever they can with as much ferocity as possible.
But without any brains. Like, so if you're in a seatbelt, you're stuck in the seatbelt where they can't like figure out how to get out. And so, which is an interesting twist. It's sort of, I don't know all the rules of zombies. But I thought,
well, no, I mentioned it because just like when we did any of our time travel stuff, like Kindred, for example, you've got to make the rules clear.
Of course, yeah.
Otherwise, anything can happen. So, and to his credit, he explains how these zombies work pretty well and how people have to deal with them and how eventually the best weapon is just kind of a knife on a stick. So you can just
go old school.
Up.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that's, I think that's a credit to him as the author too, because if you think about it, we were talking before in our Born Identity podcast about how dissimilarly to the James Bond movies where you get like M who just dumps all of this information at you, we have all of this coming to the reader's mind through these interviews. So if you think about the challenge that Max Brooks has, he needs to get all of these rules of zombieing to the reader, not through like a narrator, but through all of these different snippets here and there. And can they survive underwater? Do they thrive in warm climates versus cold climates? And all of it ends up pertaining to the World War Z, this zombie war that's taking place, but he can't say it as the narrator. So it's this very interesting kind of like, I don't know, his ability to be able to kind of sprinkle in the details here and there in to create this larger tapestry in the story that he's creating is pretty remarkable if you kind of take a step back and see what it is that he's doing there.
Well, and obviously, COVID was an airborne pathogen. We kind of talked about it with the plague in some ways, too. You can isolate a town. But the way he goes in right away with things like organ smuggling and, you know, like the stuff that's dirty and gritty and right below the surface. And I don't know. Maybe there was a news article I missed in 2005 or 2004 that made him think of this. But it's easy to think that, oh, something like the organ trade is terrible, but it will never affect me. Mm. And so to say like, oh no, we have to be aware of what's going on in the world no matter what it is an interesting way to go.
Yeah, it's an interesting way of kind of like looping that in, right? I mean, I guess we could just stop there and say not bad for the son of a famous Hollywood actor. But I think that that's not doing Max Brooks enough credit, right? I think that he's actually kind of orchestrating this story very intentionally with some of those and playing off of some of the genre there too, right? I was reminded in the very beginning of the start of Jurassic Park. It's funny that you mentioned that earlier, Mike, because with the kind of the way that this starts off kind of like in a remote location, and it starts off and thinking about the start of Jurassic Park, you have kind of like the attack that you're not really sure where it is that it's coming from, but it's a bite from a what ends up being a dinosaur in the story of Jurassic Park. And here the bite is coming from an unknown virus zombie that's now going to become a much larger and much more global threat than anything that we had encountered before. So kind of playing off of some of those tropes and some of those kind of I don't know, I'm not suggesting that he's specifically alluding to Jurassic Park with that, but I think that kind of building this global outbreak from the small and then getting much larger and much more creating much more of like a macrocosm for this zombie war. I'm giving him more and more credit as I'm making my way through this discussion, but I think that it's pretty impressive what it is that he's done.
Yeah, and I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but he has one, I forget what chapter it is, maybe the Homefront chapter, where he has the American general talking about the zombies and how effectively they're the perfect soldier, right? Because what does he say there? In traditional warfare, you have to be red, fed, and lead, I think. Yeah. So red meaning they're like red-blooded, alive. Fed, you have to keep the army fed, and you need a leader, someone to follow. The zombies have none of that, right? Because mm-hmm. they're not really living. They don't need anything to exist. They just do. But they're all independent. So there's mm-hmm. not like a unified front or a way you can attack. So it's a different form of total warfare, as you mentioned. So it's sort of like the perfect or worst-case scenario if you're a military planner or strategist or something. So yeah, it was really clever that way.
Mm-hmm. Agreed. And I'll also add, since you brought up some literary stuff that we've been talking about, I'll also bring up the geopolitical stuff, which is this book clearly came out after 9/11. And there's a whole bunch of what can civilian government do? What can the military do? One of the first people we're introduced to is a Mossad guy. And he says, a lot of the intelligence people were working on this. We were the only ones who could convince our government something bad was happening. And it just reminded me of the post 9/11 stuff, where some people in the CIA heard inklings, some in the FBI heard inklings, but no one was communicating. And then in the end, they were ignored. And so that kind of thing happened, which again, here it happened globally, except for blank, in Israel, but it's still happening with COVID. Like, we're still trying to figure out where it came from. Was it intentional? And it's weird how well he wrote some stuff that obviously we can now apply to it, but it was completely believable in the story because that's just how these intelligence agencies work.
Yeah, I think he really does a good job of understanding human nature in crisis, like how you will silo, how you'll be defensive, how you want to wall off or whatever. And that was really sharp. Yeah.
Yeah. And to kind of build off of that literary discussion too, I refuse to believe that him mentioning the Battle of the Five Colleges in a science fiction and fantasy kind of like genre is, in my opinion, totally an allusion to the Battle of the Five Armies from The Hobbit, too, yeah. Which is, I mean, I think that there's a lot of similarities there, which, of course, is kind of building off of some of the previous works of literature, right? Obviously, Tolkien being so inspired by Beowulf with the Swedish Wars that had been kind of like his inspiration for the Battle of the Five Armies. And there it is, gentlemen. I worked in my Beowulf reference. You didn't think I could do it, but I did.
20 minutes in, yes.
There we go.
I'm just curious, what do you guys think of the mile high view is like, why zombies? Why are zombies so fascinating to us in pop culture in the last 20, 25 years? Mm-hmm. What is it that is feeding or representative? You want to get Freudian or Jungian, sort of what does a zombie represent? Why is it like The Walking Dead filmed in our backyard here?
Walking Dead, Atlanta. Video games like Resident Evil, like there's
Last of Us.
Yeah, it really is all over the place.
I mean, I have my theories.
Yeah.
When we were talking about the early to mid-late Cold War, the big baddie oftentimes in sci-fi is aliens, and that's because we have someone who's very much like us, wearing all the same thing with advanced technology. And it was essentially our fear of the Soviet Union or the Chinese, right? They wear the Mao suit or whatever. They have technology we don't quite understand, and God damn it, there's a strong jawed American who's going to take care of them. Like, that's every sci-fi movie from the day the Earth stood still up until Independence Day, right? It's an allegory for how American individualism can save the day. Well, when the Cold War ends, we have a lot of these individual little fractious groups that pop up. And so now it is like stomping out a bunch of fires. Terrorism makes it all the more so. Yep. One independent terrorist with a backpack bomb can destroy all of downtown Baltimore, which they do in the movie The Sum of All Fears, for example. Mm-hmm. And I think that's part of it. We've gone from an organized force to this idea that, well, quote Marx, an idea is more dangerous than actual action. So what are these zombies? They're things that are uncontrolled, they're everywhere, and that with one touch, that idea could spread, but they're completely uncontrolled. Yeah. So it's just a different metaphor. And to wit, Romero more or less did that metaphor in Night of the Living Dead in the 1960s, right? Like, yeah. And we put on top of it communism, and we put on top of it the civil rights movement. But there is something about that idea that this thing is spreading, we can't stop it, but maybe we can resist.
Yeah, and I think that then you add on top of that the post-apocalyptic kind of lens to things as well. You brought up the Sum of All Fears and kind of the post-apocalyptic nature of that, and what happens when this world that we inhabit ends up totally and completely dissolving into anarchy and into a dystopia, right? So I think that you couple this fear that we have of the living dead and this creature that's kind of like in and among us with that post-apocalyptic nature, and what you're left with is something that is enough terrifying enough to kind of like make us worried, and also intriguing enough to make you wonder what if. And I think that when you have that kind of coupled with one another, you've got yourself something that you can create TV shows and movies and books. Yeah. And I think that you've created kind of your own video games. You've created your own genre.
Do you think there's anything about globalism in there? Like, our world is more interconnected than ever before, and there's some sort of fear about, I don't know, just the ability for things to spread, be it ideas, be it contagion. I don't know.
I would say so.
And then I'm worried about brains, right? Zombies like brains. Mm-hmm. So we worried about we've been talking a lot about AI as we're starting the school year. It's like, is that some sort of protective fear or anxiety about our own brains being attacked or being taken over? I don't know.
I feel all of the
above, right?
Well, and it's also, it might be a zeitgeist thing in that there seems to be a rotating drum of who the baddie is this week. And he just happened to hit right at the right moment. Mm-hmm. I think all of our villain types that show up say something about ourselves, you know. And I don't know. I think that's part of it. I think, I mean, you could argue that, you know, the anti-intellectualism of the W. Bush era might have had something to do with what you're saying. Like, I don't know. You could take a very racist view on this and set it with the Mexican border and these ideas that these people are coming over and we can't control. Like, there's allusions to that here.
Yeah.
Also, look to the movie, I think it's 2012. It's one of those apocalyptic movies. But like, global warming causes the ice caps to melt, so all of North America is underwater except for Mexico, and the Americans are trying to get into Mexico and they're being stopped at the border because that's sweet justice. but like, it's just, I can see... Yeah, geopolitically, like the idea that what do borders matter in some context, I think is part of it as well.
Yeah, there's got to be some really smart, sharp, you know, scholarship on that, I would think, somewhere.
Oh, could you imagine getting a doctorate on zombies? Yeah. That would be awesome.
or fear of death or distancing from death, because we're so isolated from death in most of our modern lives. Is that part of it, that you're confronted literally with the living dead? And I don't know.
This sounds like a good discussion to have with a bunch of 10th graders.
Yeah, it does.
the other constant stream, at least for the first half of the book, I should mention here because it starts right at the beginning, is Phalanx. Phalanx is a quote-unquote vaccine or preventative measure that you can take as a regular dosage, and it will prevent this zombie outbreak, but it's made with no evidence. It's ivermectin. I don't know what to tell you. It's really incredible how much he nails this.
Yeah, yeah. This was definitely the thread that I think kind of hit the nail most on the head in regards to kind of the a lot of playing off of some of the fears that wouldn't come for another almost two decades later with the vaccines, with COVID and everything there. So I really think that it was astonishing how accurately he kind of predicted that one.
Well, and like the people who are in the know are like, this can't possibly work, but people are like, yeah, sure, I'll take it. And you know, it, one of my favorite apocalypse books, which is so out of date, we don't even write anymore, Last Babylon. Mm. But they eventually interview one of these guys. He's like, we made so much money off of this.
Right.
And like the answer is like, to what end? The world is gone.
Yeah.
You know, like it's the last line of Last Babylon. We won the war, but not that it matters. Right. Like the world got destroyed. Good for you.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's it. We've set the table that the virus is now popping up all over the place. They're calling it African rabies, but we know that China is covering it up. It's potentially popping up in Europe and across the Sinai. The Israelis are building an ever bigger wall, and we get an interesting scene at the border pretty early on where they're trying to decide who to let in and who not to. And we have this kind of neutral Palestinian observer who is convinced that he's only letting in Israelis, and then he sees some Israelis drugged to the side and immediately shot. And then he realizes that something else must be going on.
Right, and that's where we start to get this, Mike, to bring up your kind of global point before, the what used to divide people now is that's no longer the line of divide. Now it's no longer Palestinian or Israeli. Now it's human and living dead, right? So that divide is now, it's just as stark, if not more stark than it was before, but it's now dividing humanity in a totally different way. I should say that at this point, we've gone from the warnings into kind of like the blames section. And that blames section ends when they realize that the phalanx, this vaccine that they've been using, is indeed just a placebo. It's not actually doing anything, which incites what's called the great denial. That's in the midst of the great denial. Once they realize that the truth comes out with this placebo vaccine, it creates the great panic, which is the third kind of like section that we get in our story, where you get countries around the world responding to this great panic. They're no longer able to deny the reality of this zombie apocalypse, and all the countries kind of respond in their individual ways, which leads into kind of like the turning of the tide, which I think is the fourth section.
That's right. And again, just, we can't talk about all these things, but credit where credit's due. Like, he gives it so much credit. Like, at one point in the beginning, he's in the Amazon rainforest in Brazil. I mentioned Brazil earlier. But like, he's blindfolded because since society's fallen apart, these people have moved to the jungle and they're trying to keep their society insulated. So now we have like, it's apocalypse now. There's like a Colonel Kurtz out there who's created his own society, and like, the one person they needed was a surgeon, and they're protecting the surgeon who was working in the organ tree. Like, it's just incredible all the stuff he thought through here.
Yeah.
And I just want to keep giving him credit for this, because I don't know how you, because what it is it's almost a collection of 40 short stories.
Yeah, exactly. I was going to say something really similar to that, Nick. I almost want to see his notebook and see like the grand map that he's creating here, because each time you make your way into kind of like that new section, whether it's moving from denial into, or from blame into denial into kind of like the panic that sets in, each time you're given yet another lens and yet another glimpse at another country and how it is that they're responding in the midst of the information that they have. So like it's at this point that it's revealed that Russia is having like insurrection and rebellions that are taking place,
right,
that they're trying to put down. Ukraine ends up like decimating entire villages with gas in order to try and root out the zombies that are living there. Iran and Pakistan like incite a nuclear winter as a result of the like the detonation of nuclear bombs and nuclear destruction based off of a misunderstanding. So like all of these different countries, and then later on we'll get kind of the aftermath of that. So we're seeing it right in the midst of the height of the zombie apocalypse, and then at the end of the story it comes back around and you get to see how each of these countries who responded in each of these different ways has each of them their separate kind of aftermath challenges that they're needing to deal with after the war 10 years later has ended. They're still dealing with the repercussions in the wake of this world war. So I want to see the notebook that he's using to kind of like connect the dots here in order to create piecemeal, though it may be, this very thorough story of the zombie war.
Yeah. And we'll get to, in part two, which is, I think, Blame?
Mm-hmm.
Is that where you are?
Yeah.
That some of this stuff is incredibly creative. Like, he thinks, he has fun, he thinks through problems that we wouldn't otherwise think of, because humans are kind of everywhere. Like, so Blame starts off talking to the head of the CIA, and he's like, the problem with the Cold War was we were worried about corruption getting in. So the people who were there were just brown nosers, and they weren't very talented. I think the line he uses is brown nosing myopic eunuchs, which is really great.
Yeah.
The only smart agents were the ones who stayed there out of patriotism.
Yep.
But again, it sounds a lot like the rumors post-COVID, because they're like, well, we thought something was going on in China, but we didn't know really what it was. The military were sweeping people up and making them disappear. And then there was a crisis in the Strait of Taiwan, which again, huh.
Yeah, and it gets pretty kind of like anti-nationalistic in there too, with like the and I'm intrigued as well now knowing that Max Brooks had taught at the War College, and seeing that he does have this military background in. I think that it gives us kind of another layer to look at the Battle of Yonkers that ends up being this, like, it's just repeated again and again by the different generals and soldiers that are in this. It's supposed to be this like great propaganda nationalistic moment, and it ends up with the U.S. president having like a panic attack and them having absolutely no idea what it is that they're in for. That alongside kind of like the almost humorous like the Battle of the Hamptons that they describe in there, with like all of the super wealthy elite that have their like bodyguards who are one by one being picked off by zombies, and the like celebrity that has his rifle in his hand that he wants to think of himself as like Scarface, and he's like, he didn't have the heart to tell him that it was that it was a totally different gun that he was using. And it's kind of like this, even in the context of the story, they were trying to use these different battles to like televise over TV and show just how strong and united America is, and at every turn the zombies win, right? At least at this point in the story. And so it's almost kind of like anti-nationalistic in that sense, where it's, and I mean, to have a president who like essentially has a nervous breakdown and needs to kind of like flee to Honolulu.
Right.
It's a very interesting and critical view of kind of that nationalistic pride that you would probably assume that Max Brooks would have.
And I'll just add here, I think You were talking about your cynicism about whether or not Max Brooks could do such a thing. Mm. I think in some ways humor and horror are linked very tightly because they both play to the extremes of emotion, and you have to have empathy with your subject or with the person you're writing to or telling the joke to, and then just accelerate it. Mm. And I think you can see that in the military side, means of course it would be battles in New York and New Jersey and in Boston, because that's a heavily populated area. But by taking names like Yonkers, like that to me is just, to make something dramatic in Yonkers just sounds very silly to me because that's the wordsmith in him who's his dad's son, and he knows like this is how you make someone remember something, by giving it a silly name and then adding import to it.
Well, yeah, just like I'm thinking of that classic saying that comedy is tragedy plus time, right? So here they're immersed in this tragedy, but you can't help but think, the comic sort of, because humans are not rational, clearly, and so this is what ensues. Mike, I'm curious, just as a writer, like, what did, and as your enthusiasm or appreciation is growing, do you think you can use this, or this is a unique structure that only works for something like this, or for like incorporating different points of view, or like you said, variations on a theme, or 40 different short stories or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. It is super intriguing to me, the construction of it. Right. And I'm sitting here thinking about, well, the next kind of like plot item I have on the list is Paul Redeker's, the South African consultant who uses people as like live bait in this story in order to kind of like the survival of the mass being more important than the survival of the few, and using people as live bait, which is a terrifying, horrifying kind of like image and ideology. Yet it's put right in the middle of the story, almost as though this is when the characters that are immersed in this fictional war are at their wit's end, and they're left with absolutely nothing. That's when it is that they're resorting to this South African consultant's kind of new ideology and viewpoint, and he's heralded as this like great savior of humanity for having this like live bait humanity kind of like approach to the zombie apocalypse. But to answer your question, I'm sitting here wondering, well, what if that had been first? What if rather than the quote Jurassic Park kind of start to the story, what if we had started with the Battle of Yonkers? What if we had started with that very small microcosm of, and I think it's even called a microcosm in the story, of the Battle of the Five Colleges, and then kind of like expounded from there? And so I think that while it's definitely true that you're getting all these little snippets and vignettes as a way of creating this mosaic that is the kind of like the greater tapestry of this work, I have a huge appreciation for, I think, what it is that he's able to accomplish. Whether you want to talk about the nitty-gritty, whether you liked it at the sentence level or not, I'm very intrigued and very impressed by the ability to tell an entire story with these snippets, because some of them are really short. Some of them are just like a page or a couple of pages, whereas others are four or five pages because it needs to give a little bit of a greater view of what's happening in the nation of Russia at this time. So I am definitely intrigued to see in a postmodern way if this can be something that can be applied to other larger stories to try and tell it in these snippets.
And you're, go ahead, Mick.
Oh, no, please. I was just going to add, this is also not necessarily a morality tale. There are people who act well and people who don't, but like, it's very early on in the book that we meet the guy who made all the money off the vaccine, and now he's living in Antarctica, so you know he's not going to get any justice. He did it. He's gone, right? Yeah. And we also meet the chief of staff for the president, who's now literally working. He's working at a bioelectrical plant, but he does it by literally shoveling shit. Like, he shovels manure into the... So, like, the morality... This isn't a morality tale. This isn't, like, a horror book that we've talked about in class or something. There's just something about... This is about humanity in some way.
Life's not fair, right?
And
zombies aren't fair, I guess. And,
you know, but at the same time, this isn't the first epistolary novel. I mean, this is a novel that finds its success, I think, in some ways through its structure, or it's definitely finds its uniqueness through its structure. So I don't know. I don't know why it is that it works so well. Maybe just thinking about that epistolary nature of, you know, Tim O'Brien comes to mind in terms of kind of like those short snippets or those vignettes in such a way as to amalgamate a story about war to get to kind of like that deeper understanding of something as large scale as a war. Maybe there's something to a little bit more accuracy through those very specific, detailed kind of instances. I will say that last year I was at a writer's conference with a thrillers writer, Alex Levy, and he was talking about how in the perfect novel, if he were to create it, it would be entirely dialogue. There wouldn't be any, in a thriller story, there wouldn't be any sort of detail. There wouldn't be any sort of long descriptive paragraphs. It would just be strictly through the detail, almost in like a very cinematic way, that in his opinion, that would be, and I think that gears itself a little bit towards what he likes to write. But that was the kind of like the creme de la creme for him of what it would mean to write like the best thriller story. And I can't help but think about this here, where you basically only get dialogue here. Yes, there are a couple of descriptions that we get that are embedded in those epistolary accounts, but for the most part, this is just dialogue. But it's not through the characters really that makes it so intriguing. It's through this, all of these different voices that are telling this story that make it so interesting. I don't know. I'm really struck by the by kind of like the structure of it and how well it works. And you know, Mike, you did bring up Tim O'Brien earlier on, and that the more that I'm talking about it, I'm kind of like circling my way back to it, that I see a lot of that structure here.
And as you're talking to it, and I wonder, there's apparently an original screenplay that got scrapped, and then the
Brad Pitt one
got produced, which again is just sort of a very liberal interpretation of what we've read. But you think of like all those like History Channel shows where you have like the surviving people in the chair. It's like a talking head sort of interview, and it's like an amalgamation of these different people who were there. So it's almost like a documentary in that way. Mm-hmm. And but when you're talking about dialogue, I mean, it's all show and no tell then, right? Yeah. If you can craft it that way. And then also, just as a writer, I mean, the voices are very distinct, and I'm sure he spent a lot of time crafting that. But they're also very military in its own way. I think he's tipping his war college or his military expertise because they're so full of jargon and all that. But yet again, very believable universe that he's creating around those sort of acronyms and military speak, code language, I guess. It's not off-putting. Like there's some, you know, sci-fi stuff that can be jargony and sort of bizarre, but it's seamless, or it seems natural for those characters, I would say.
Well, I mean, it's still an apocalypse, but I think the constantly shifting voices also helps it from being too dour or depressing. It prevents it from being on the same note too long, which I think helps the flow, too. This, I don't know about you, but for a book that's 350-ish pages, it flew by.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And I think to that point, it stays fresh, right? You get how different are the instances of the surgeon who's in this operation room with this person who's being essentially like resurrected as a result of this virus, and then the battle in the Hamptons in like the mansions with all the security, right? It's totally different, and it adds such fresh glimpses. So, all right, Max, you did an all right job. We'll have to give it to
you. It'd be a great creative writing assignment, though, to adapt this in its own screenplay, because you clearly have that, but how can you incorporate the voices, or where do you get, how do you figure out which ones are important to cut it to the essence to tell a story or something?
I mean, or tell a story in this world, because you could have the kids write 30 different stories in the same, you know, within the same.
What point of view is missing, and you write a new voice for it or something like that?
Totally.
That could be really fun.
It does a good job. It does well in that aspect, I think. I don't know where you're.
I've got a little bit of kind of just the next couple of plot points. So we've got it's at this time after the Paul Redeker has his kind of like consulting inspiration to use people as live bait. We go to Homefront USA, which is the next kind of major section, which is on the USS Saratoga. There's kind of like a meeting of the military elite, and they decide to take the war to the zombies. And it's at this time that like the US kind of is on the front line of making sure that soldiers have proper armor to be able to combat these zombies, and they have proper weapons. We know enough about the enemy at this point to know that we need to be aiming for the head rather than the chest. These are all things that they didn't know earlier on. They have proper training for the soldiers, or as close to that as they can get, in kind of this attempt at bringing the battle back to the zombies. And it's there where we kind of jump ahead very quickly, I think, into kind of like 3 years later, where we have the kind of victory that has been declared. And it's declared in different countries at different paces, in China and in the US. They're kind of the first ones to kind of declare a victory for humanity, I guess you could say. In England, they were a little bit slower because London was still infested, and they didn't want to have too many casualties. It's kind of like a proper English thing, that they weren't on the same wavelength as the US and China, who were far more militaristic in their approach. And then Then of course, poor Russia that is now in total shambles as a result of trying to both combat the zombies and also this rebellion that was going on in their country. So we get kind of like the immediate end of the war, but not quite yet, as kind of the story is continuing to unfold there.
Yeah, and we should reference here that there's an acknowledgement that the war will probably go on forever. We get these stories of as like Scandinavia, the Bifrost mm-hmm. melts, those that were frozen solid melt and come back to life.
Yeah.
And they mentioned because an industry essentially stops and cities are on fire, we get this like nuclear winter where it's like the coldest, longest winter we've ever had.
Yeah, that's right.
Which means that there's potentially millions of zombies frozen that could come loose at any time. Like it's... They do a good job of setting.
And the oceans are full of them as well. Yeah, so that was an interesting touch.
Yeah, it's kind of like zombies everywhere you look, right? And it's at this point where it's almost like Max Brooks is trying to like one item at a time be like, you're not out of it yet, you're not out of it yet, you're not out of it yet. Like the nuclear winter that's come as a result of all the people around the world like burning these fires and burning these natural resources, coupled with the Iranian and Pakistanian like nuclear destruction that's taking place there. So we have this like nuclear winter. And so many other, I feel like, zombie stories, it's like, oh, but they can't go in the water, so you're safe there. Right. It's like, okay, but Iceland is like totally and completely screwed because they're not only isolated on their own island, but these zombies can indeed survive underwater. And they thrive in the colder climate as well. So it's like, nope, you're not good in the cold. You're not good underwater. It's like one at a time, you get all of these different different aspects of zombie survival that you think that you'd be okay with, but yet you're not. So it's kind of like, it's interesting how it is that he's doing that.
And they've eaten all the fish. The fish are gone, right? Like, and then we talk about just, at this point we were in Iraq, but he wrote this, but we're talking about urban combat, right? Mm-hmm. America and a lot of the newer cities are at ground level. But he's talking about, well, the thing is you can dig down. And part of the reason we get this great surly Frenchman who talks about how they had this brigade of people who went through the Parisian catacombs to root out the zombies, and that we lost 90% of our people because it's death pits. But we mm-hmm. had to clear them, unlike those English who took their time, right? Yeah. He's a real, which again, surly against the English, nailed it. But then we get what I think is one of the scariest parts, which is that South Korean guy talking about what happened to North Korea.
Yeah. And the fallout shelters, right? And the like hiding underneath the fallout shelters. And one day they were there and then the next day they were
just
gone.
Just disappear, yeah. Right.
And so we don't know if there's a new society. We don't know if they're, or it's just literally like the Fallout video game where there's these lockdown shelters and they're just gone. Like, it's one of those moments that's truly, and this is Around the World and Above if you're following at home, but it's that one, and then the one about the one guy who survives on the International Space Station are the chapters that always stick with me as true moments of horror, because this is a normal, like, three-person crew on the ISS, and they're literally watching the world get destroyed.
Yeah.
And they are one by one dying off, trying to figure out how we're going to survive. They find a Chinese space station, and it's been decimated. Like, literally, they're getting signal. The two people on it kill each other. And so they, like, rob it for parts. Otherwise, they never would have made it. And so now he's in Australia dying slowly from, like, years of malnutrition watching the apocalypse. And it's just... it's incredible story of isolation, right? Like, it's amazing.
Yeah, and if, talk about, like, from the writer's perspective, too, not only do you have a zombie story, but now you have zombies at the International Space Station, right? So it's like you're compounding on top of the sci-fi, even more sci-fi, and it gets even more, like, intricately woven. And, it's cool. It's for sure cool.
The impudence of being unable to do anything. But also, it's just like, where else are humans? And, like, so we have Antarctic research stations. We have the International Space Station. We have people living in jungles. We have people living under the ground. Like, he thought this through.
There's no safe place, right? Yeah.
You know, you just imagine he sat down with his dad over a scotch and it's like, so where am I missing people? He goes, did you talk about the Hamptons?
Yeah.
And he goes, you know what? Screw the Hamptons. Like, so like, it's just, it's so fantastic the way that, again, you get there and you're just, And you're right. Like, at this point, we have the Redeker plan, and it's such an American, like, they're all on these boats out in the middle of the ocean, and he's like, God damn it, we're going to take the war to the zombies. And you just imagine the flag flapping.
Yeah, the general with the cigar in the mouth. And yeah, it's all right there, and it's so, like, visual, right? And yet, you don't have any paragraphs. Well, I guess that there are a few. There's always like those paragraphs right before you get into the interviews, right? Yeah. Where it's almost like you're getting kind of like a little bit of that glimpse, a little bit. Mike, you were talking about show don't tell type of an instance, and you get a little bit of that show with some of those paragraphs leading into the interviews. But for the most part, you don't have any descriptions of like descriptive paragraphs right. that are in there. It's all just from the voices of these characters. And so kind of making the way into the end of the story, you get kind of like the overhunting that has decimated like the food population. You have the overuse of fuel that's going to keep the, it seems like, humanity in like a new like ice age almost for the coming years. And then you have like the resurgence of things like the Spanish flu that the outlook still looks bleak even after the quote end of the zombie war. And yet it's still kind of like a little bit, I don't know. I'm curious to hear your opinions about the end of the story, whether you think that it ends more optimistically than pessimistically, or what was your both view on the end of the story?
Yeah, I would say it's optimistic, or they're just living with this new reality. They've found a way to cope or move forward, but the zombies are never going away. They're always going to deal with them. And then back to what I was referencing before about the perfect enemy. Like, not only can you, if you don't kill them, they kill you and you add to their numbers, right? Mm. So it's increasing the foe effectively. And that's always a losing equation, essentially. But I thought it was fairly optimistic at the end. I mean, just, yeah, I would say it's hopeful, or at least some sort of, it's not as bleak, like not as doomed feeling to me. I don't know.
No, I mean, I pair it with the idea that to say something is pessimistic is that the world is over, right? So I agree with you there, but like it's also saying that the old order is much more tenuous than we think, mm-hmm. right? Because like at that at the conference, there's a scene where the French attaché cracks out a bottle of like Chateau Latour, like, and it's like, this is the last bottle that will possibly ever exist. And it's this example, like, this is the end of quote-unquote civilization, right. Yeah. right? And, like, the rest of the book, we're being introduced to, like, one of the shamans in charge of the new Russian religious order, right? Yeah. Like, and, like, the world has changed, but humanity survives. Maybe it's optimistic in that way. Like,
well, would you say survives or resets? I mean, the way that Russia is described with, like, the women that are forced to kind of like bear the children of statesmen now, yeah. and the different kind of like there were convicts that were kind of like thrown out into the wild that are now starting their own factions, like survival factions. It's almost like it feels like things have been maybe even more reset than renewed, I guess you could say. I don't know. It's a strangely kind of like non commentary end to the story. I was definitely curious to hear what you guys thought about it.
Yeah, I mean, you say non-commentary. It's fairly unemotional throughout all this, which is the whole, maybe that's the military tone or that approach, that it's just like, just the facts, ma'am, kind of approach. But then the reset makes me think, obviously, of Cuba, which has a complete sort of like positive revolution, right? They become the wealthiest, most powerful nation in the world. Which I thought was clever in its own way, and how they pivot.
Do you think that there's any kind of tip of the hat there to like the U.S. coming out of World War II and the kind of like
the rise of a new superpower? Yeah. Yeah, I think when you have a like worldwide cataclysm, there has to be a shift in power and power structure. So
Well, and there was, and it is also like, who is the world for now? Which is something that isn't told here. Like, there isn't a lot of like families and people that we talk about, and there's like one person at the end we talk about briefly, but like we get that story right as the war is at its height, kind of the guy in Japan, the otaku, who's like, who literally doesn't know how to survive in society at all. Falls, like, literally has to climb down a 19 story building.
Is that the one with the bear that like the
and it's just like, the world is over
for him. Balcony to balcony, right?
Yeah. Because like he can't. There's no way that the world is ever coming back for him. But you know, there are people in like New Mexico who's like, "Well, I'm the new head of the SEC," and you're just like, "Oh, right, good for you, buddy." But like, you know, like I think that's what's interesting too. It's a complete reset in some ways of society.
Yeah. So I guess that's why I say it's almost optimistic in humans' ability to adapt to their new reality, adapt and endure, perhaps. Yeah. Maybe I'm reading too much into that, but yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, and I think that it's just so interesting of all the nations, Cuba, to have be kind of like during the Cuban Missile Crisis and the kind of the hairs width away from nuclear destruction that we were as a result there, and then now in this fictional war that's now transpired that we're in the aftermath of, it's like that place that was so intricately connected with possible decimation and destruction is now kind of like the nation that
the rebirth,
that,
right?
That has been reborn in kind of an interesting way.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
Yeah, I like a book that makes me almost sad that it's over. Because when it ended, I was like, wait a minute, we should tell more stories here. It really does a good job. And like, you do get this feeling that it's just, because even the cleanup, like we get the dude who, there's a woman who has a sled and she's just shoveling bodies onto the sled, right? And you're just like, oh, this, when it all melts, there's going to be more of these people. It feels, but now it's not overwhelming anymore. It's the persistent problem. It turned out that COVID just became an annual thing.
Right.
Yeah. Like, it's just, anyway.
But I think that it's interesting that you say, Nick, that you got to the end of it and you were like sad that it was over. Because if you think about it, there were probably close to 40 or 50 different like vignettes and interviews that are in here. And I would be hard pressed to be able to try to think up 40 or 50 different interesting interviews from different perspectives around the world without getting to the end and thinking to myself, okay, well, did we really need all 50 of those?
Right, yeah.
But that's not how I felt at the end of it. I felt like, you know, I did get a whole global oral history of the zombie war as a result of this. And had you not had all of those different little snippets that were in there, and Nick, even just as you were talking about the young like coder from China who had been like jumping down from balcony to balcony, that's not even the same as the story, I don't think, of the person who was in like the Tibetan wilderness who encountered the bear that was, and there's so many stories across this oral history that's being told here. And I got to the end and I didn't think to myself, you know, we could have done with 10 less of those. And I don't know if that's testimony to just how fresh each of those little vignettes and little stories felt, or if that was kind of just the way that the story was structured. But it felt like it was the right length, which a story that has 50 interviews like that, I think that that's testimony to how well the story's been created.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, it's no fluff really at all.
Yeah, I wonder if he didn't have like 70 of them and he just
edited
them down.
What's the original draft look like? Yeah, exactly.
Because it is very.
That's what makes it so readable and so enjoyable, I think, because it just flies by and then you don't feel it never slows down because it's always going to change point of view or place in the world or in a different time frame. Yeah, that's great.
Yeah. I guess we should do our final thoughts here because that's kind of where we are. I'll start with you, Mr. Burns. What do you think?
I loved it. Again, I was surprised at the depth of it and the craft of it, as we've been talking about. And yeah, definitely would recommend this. And it would be fun to teach. I would like to try and incorporate this somehow.
I'll let you go last this time. No, just so I don't seem like I'm the only one who does it. I agree with you. I picked it up. And it's not that it was a hefty book in the way that some of the other ones were, but I'm like, it's thicker than I remember. But I've rarely had a book fly by this well. And like you, I kind of switched between I did the unabridged audiobook, but the audiobook and this. And I can recommend both because they hire a different actor each time. So each of the voices is distinct, which helps it from getting monotonous.
The audiobook is fantastic, I think, yeah.
But he thinks of a whole bunch of interesting angles to take it from. And I don't think he hit them all, so there's room to talk about, obviously. But the book is never boring. It's often depressing. It's often very intense. But it's never boring. So I give it that. Mr. Carroll?
Yeah, just hearing you guys talk about the audiobook, I think that this is a story that's really made for an audiobook, mm-hmm. right? It's an oral history of a fictional war. I mean, what better structure for...
And you mentioned, I think it's somewhere I read he was influenced by Orson Welles. Yeah. Yeah, mm-hmm. right.
Yeah. Yeah, so I think that there's definitely some aspect of this being an oral history, and being able to hear it through an audiobook form has got to be kind of leaning right into that, I think. But I think, okay, so when I took this chair, I was ready to talk about how in some ways some of the structure did for me get like a little bit stale at points, just in terms of the repetitive. You get it kind of like 50 times over this intro, and then you get the "it was way worse than we ever thought that it was," and then we get the kind of like unique spin that comes on it, and then you get the clever one-liner that ends it, and then we go into the next interview. And I think in some ways but that's just the structure. And when I took this chair, I was ready to kind of critique that a little bit. But hearing you guys talk about it and kind of talking my way into it too, I think that I've grown to appreciate that structure a little bit more. And I did like it. I liked it a lot. It was definitely unlike anything that I've read. Even unlike other epistolary novels that I've read. But if you take this to be an oral history of a fictional zombie war, I mean, I think that he hits it right on the head. I think that he does a really good job with it. So,
well, thanks for listening. Our next book is going to be Station 11 by Emily St. John Mandel. Mm-hmm. And keep doing what you do to keep us on the charts. To, as we're talking, we're actually charted in Israel. So there you go.
There we go.
But review, share us, talk about us. Obviously, he's on Insta.
Yep, michael.c.carroll. So thanks for everybody for following along, and thanks for all the support that that you guys are giving, not just to the podcast, but also to me as an author and me as a writer. So can't thank you guys enough.
Yeah, and I have a required reading Twitter as well, you can find. We keep on trucking, so we'll see in a few weeks as we talk about Station 11. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks.
Required Reading is a product of Bears Podcasting and Dude Letter Podcasting. It's hosted by Nick Hoffman and co-hosted by Mike Burns and Mike Carroll. It is edited and produced by Nick Hoffman. The theme is Sands by Davis Burns. The opinions expressed are opinions of the hosts and the guests, but not of Marist School. All rights reserved. Thanks!